That'll bring us to the middle chapter, which is about Mendelian and non-Mendelian inheritance. Mendelian inheritance is named after Mendel. Oh, that one sucks. In his honor. How famous is Mendel? Have you heard of Mendel before coming to the course? Okay. It's good that he's becoming more and more famous. He's now known as the father of modern genetics, but he was totally unappreciated in his lifetime, so he didn't really get any credit until after he was dead. Do you know which one of these monks is Mendel? Is he so famous you can spot him? It's this one right here. In fact, I think he's holding a pea flower, and he's famous for working with peas to figure out how genetics works well before we had any idea what a gene was or what DNA is. So he lived in the mid-1800s, or he worked in the mid-1800s with peas. This is when he figured out, over like 7 years of experiments, how inheritance works, which is pretty impressive considering he had no idea what the molecules are. And part of the reason he was so successful is because he was unusual for his time compared to biologists at that time. Biology was mostly an observational science rather than an experimental science. So there were naturalists mostly. People went out and cataloged all the living things in that area, described them. Wasn't so much an experimental science. And so they didn't really have a feel for important things about experimentation, like sample size. You know, you don't do an experiment on a single subject. You're not going to get meaningful statistical results if you do that. Biologists were not statistically minded back in Mendel's time. But he was, and he thankfully did his experiments over and over using tens of thousands of pea plants, which takes a hell of a lot of time because to notice any change, you have to wait a season before these things grow up. So it's not something you do overnight. It probably helped that he was a monk and could concentrate on this. But in the second slide, we can see his basic technique. Using pea plants, he used more than just pea plants, but mostly pea plants. Pea plants are examples of plants that have both male and female parts in the same individual. In a flowering plant, which are most plants, the flower is the reproductive organ where the reproductive structures are found, and male parts of flowers are called stamens. They're just slender things, and they have a bulbous end called an anther, which is where pollen is formed, and pollen contains sperm. So the stamens are the gonads, the male gonads of the flower. The carpel, this bowling pin shaped thing, is the female structure. And the bulbous part of the bowling pin contains the ovary where the eggs are formed. And so fertilization, of course, requires sperm to meet up with egg. That requires, in a pea plant, pollen grains to land on the sticky end of the carpel, called the stigma. And then they bore a tunnel all the way through the length of it to find an egg and then fertilize it. And usually that happens just randomly. You know, a bee will come along and just accidentally pick up pollen, take it to another flower. That happens all the time. Or wind blows, whatever. Plants don't mate, right? They are sexual reproducers, but they don't mate. Plants don't meet each other even. They're planted in place. But their gametes have to meet somehow in order for fertilization to occur. Well, for an experimental setting, Mendel recognized that he had to be in charge of who the parents are. And so he had to carefully After actually he did a long time of preparation to make sure he was working with the correct kinds of plants, he then had to carefully remove the stamens, the male parts of flowers, so that it would prevent self-fertilization. In other words, the pollen from this flower would not be allowed to fertilize that same flower. And then in go to another field where he had the ones he was going to use as the females, or as the males actually, and carefully collect pollen with a brush, and then take it to the ones that he's removed the males' parts from, and brush that pollen onto those. So he was the boss of who the two parents were in all of his crosses, in other words. And he did this same technique for at least seven major experiments that were conducted the same way, except there were just different variables in each one. He cared about different things in each one, but that required keeping them all separate. So he had to have separate fields with hundreds or thousands of plants in each one for many years. Well, if you successfully do this, it's not instantaneous results, right? You have to wait to see whether the fruit is formed. Flowers produce fruit. Fruit contain the offspring. So the fruit of a pea plant is a pea pod containing some number of peas. Each pea is an individual. All right. So the two parents make up what is called the parental generation or the pea generation. That's what he worked with directly. Then he waited for the offspring, which are the peas. Each pea in a pod are like brothers and sisters. They're separate individuals with different genetic characteristics. And then he would plant the peas and let them grow up, and then look at that next generation of plants, which are called the first filial generation or the F1 generation. And then, as we'll see, he could cross those with each other and do the same thing and wait for the F2 generation. This is why it took so long to get results. And he wouldn't have been able to figure out anything if he hadn't done it hundreds or thousands of times to get good sample sizes. Okay, now, before I talk about the particulars of slide 3, I need to give you some definitions. Because in everyday life, we more or less use the words characteristic and trait interchangeably. Or I think we do. But they're not interchangeable in genetics. They have distinct meanings. And it's easiest just to give you an example rather than to try to describe the difference. A characteristic is just something about an organism. But a good example shown here is flower color. That is a characteristic. The difference between that and trait, though, is that a trait is some specific value of that characteristic, and there can be multiple traits for the same characteristic. Just like here, there are two possible colors, purple flowers and white flowers. Purple and white are traits. Flower color is the characteristic that those traits are examples of. Okay, that's the difference. So keep that in mind. And another thing that Mendel did carefully is that he only paid attention to one characteristic at a time. When I mentioned his seven major experiments a little bit ago in his different fields, they were all conducted the same way with respect to the scissors and the brush. But what was different about each one is that he paid attention to a different characteristic in each batch. He didn't care about any other characteristics. So in this one, what he cared about was flower color. That's the one characteristic. And before he could even do this, he had to make sure he had true breeding parents. True breeding parents are ones that, if they are crossed, always produce offspring like themselves. So purple-flowered individuals would have to give rise to only purple-flowered individuals if they're crossed with another purple-flowered. That's a true breeder. Same with the white. And that takes time just growing them and looking at the offspring to make sure you have the right kind. But what we see here is a cross. Now, a cross simply means one parent crossed with another parent. But this is more specifically an example of what's called a monohybrid cross. There are different kinds of crosses. The hybrid part of the word refers to a mixture of some sort, right? Hybrids are mixtures. What makes this a hybrid cross is that the two parents of the P generation have different traits for the characteristic you're looking at. They're not both purple, they're not both white. One's purple and one's white, so that's a hybrid cross. Mono means one. So the reason that this is more specifically a monohybrid cross is that there's only one characteristic that you care about. You're ignoring what the leaves look like or how tall the plants are or any other characteristic. All you care about is flower color. Okay? So that's a monohybrid cross. And when he did this, and then waited and looked at the next generation once they grew up, after he planted the peas, when he looked at the flowers of the F1 generation, the hundreds, what he noticed is that every one of the pea plants had, in the F1 generation, had purple flowers. Not only were they all purple, they were all fully purple, just as purple as the purple-flowered parent. And if you consider this, that's kind of surprising, because for thousands of years before Mendel, we recognized in nature that sexual species have offspring that have traits that are kind of shared by, are a mixture of both parents, right? You don't look just like one parent or just like the other. You have traits from both. So it would be reasonable to predict that the F1s would all be purplish white, not fully purple or not fully white, right? But he didn't see that. Every one of them was fully purple, just like the purple-flowered parent, and there were no white ones. And he could have just left it at that and said, that's kind of curious. But he then crossed F1s with other F1s. Brothers mixed with sisters, in other words. And planted those seeds once they appeared and then waited the next season until they grew up for the F2 generation. And what he saw in the F2 generation is a famous Mendelian ratio, a 3-to-1 ratio, which is why it's so important that he did hundreds. If you did this with one plant, you wouldn't notice this. But these are real numbers. 705 purple-flowered individuals in the F2, 224 in white individuals, which is almost exactly a 3-to-1 ratio. And so this is very weird, right? He noticed that white seemed to disappear for a generation and then come back in the following generation, whereas white seemed to be dominated in the F1 generation by the purple. And so that gave rise to the two terms, dominant trait and recessive trait. The dominant trait dominates over the recessive trait. So that's what shows, that's what actually is apparent. So that in this case, the dominant trait is purple. It dominates over white. The recessive trait is so-called because recessive is the adjective form of recede, which means to hide, right? To pull back or hide. And that's what it seems to do for a generation, and then it comes back out. Well, he wouldn't have these results if it weren't careful, but that, even careful as he was, that doesn't explain anything yet, especially if you don't have any idea about DNA or anything. We'll explain it in a minute, though. What he was able to explain, though, without knowing molecularly what was going on, is that there seemed to be discrete particles, as I think he called them, that were being passed on from parent to offspring. And that's why you could have these integer ratios, 100% or 3-to-1 ratio, because there were actually discrete particles. He had no idea that what he was talking about were chromosomes. But that's what we know now, of course. In slide 4, though, we see a table showing his 7 major experiments. These are the ones that were conducted all the same way I was talking about. But each row is a different experiment, and in each row he cared about a different characteristic, but only one at a time. So every one of these is a monohybrid cross. And probably the most important aspect of this is that in all of these different experiments, you can see his real numbers of how many hundreds or thousands he did, he got an almost exact 3-to-1 ratio in the F2 of the dominant trait, 3 dominants for every 1 recessive traited individual in the F2. And all of them in the F1 had only 1 trait, the dominant trait. Now, that 3-to-1 ratio is a Mendelian ratio that happens in Mendelian genetics, named in his honor. But not all things happen that way. It will happen that way if a couple things are true. And so I'll explain that more after I talk about slide 5. It'll be easier. Slide 5 is a way to explain this at the chromosomal level. So slide 5 shows you 2 chromosomes. Now, this does not mean that that a pea plant has 2 chromosomes only. The reason that only these 2 chromosomes are shown is because we don't care about anything other than flower color. All right? And flower color is controlled by a gene that's only on 1 of the chromosomes, however many there are. I don't know what the N is for pea plants. So the other chromosomes are there, and the other characteristics are there. We just are ignoring them for the sake of the experiment, right? We're focusing on flower color. But why are there 2 here? Why are there 2 chromosomes? Well, originally, yes. But within this individual from which these are taken, it's a diploid. Pea plants are diploid individuals. So there are 2 of every type of chromosome. I don't know what chromosome number this is from the karyotype, but it's the only one that has a gene that controls flower color. Okay? Now, there are thousands of genes on this chromosome, and just like we're ignoring the other chromosomes that don't have anything to do with flower color, we're also ignoring all the genes that on this same chromosome that don't have anything to do with flower color. There is 1 gene here, though, that we care about because it does correspond to flower color. And for any given gene, right now we're interested in flower color gene, but for any given gene, that gene is a real thing. It's a sequence of DNA that's a subset of the overall long sequence that makes up the whole chromosome, right? So it is somewhere, a real thing that has an actual place. And that place or location of that particular gene is called its locus. Same root as in location, just another word really for location. Okay, so a gene locus is the position of that gene on its chromosome. Now, what I haven't given you a definition of yet is the word allele. What makes this the flower color gene is that that's the characteristic that it controls. But even though we say the flower color gene, there can be multiple versions of it, or for any other given gene. All right, so there can be multiple different versions of a single gene, and those multiple different versions are each called alleles. To hopefully make this easier to understand, think of this correspondence. A gene corresponds to a characteristic, as I defined it. That's why we call it the flower color gene, because flower color is a characteristic. Each individual allele of that gene corresponds to a particular trait of that characteristic. And that's why we have a purple allele here and a white allele. Now, there's no limit to the number of alleles that could possibly exist in a population. But in his population of pea plants, there were only two for flower color. Each allele, if you think about just the whole population as a collection of alleles, flower color alleles, there were only two possibilities for each allele, purple or white. And this is one of the requirements for inheritance to work in a Mendelian fashion. When we talk about Mendelian inheritance, there's two requirements that I was about to say in the last slide. I said this would make more sense to wait. One of those requirements is that there has to be exactly two alleles for whatever characteristic you're looking at. Not two or more, exactly two. The other requirement for Mendelianity is that one of those two alleles has to completely dominate over the other. And that was true in this flower color one, but I don't know whether it was luck or by his design. Maybe he threw out some experiments. I'm not sure of the history. But all six of the other ones also had exactly two possible alleles, and one of them was completely dominant over the other. Now, another way of saying this, that's the molecular way of saying it. Exactly two alleles for each gene is the molecular way of saying it. You could also say there has to be exactly two possible traits for the characteristic, but they correspond. Now, so this is the truth of this population. There are only two possible alleles in the population, but it's a population of diploid individuals. So each individual has two of the chromosome that carries the flower color gene on it. So each diploid individual, therefore, has two flower color alleles, as you see here, right? Since there are two possible alleles, though, in the population, that means there's three possibilities for individuals, only one of which is shown here. Remember, an individual has both chromosomes, so this is one individual we're looking at. One possibility is that this one that you're looking at, which is there's one of each type of allele in that individual. One allele is dominant, the other is recessive. Okay, we call that heterozygous. We call that individual a heterozygous individual. It's a word that means different zygotes. The reason it makes sense is because if this individual reproduces, it can produce different kinds of zygotes depending on which allele it passes to the offspring. But hetero means different, and zygous refers to zygote production. The other major possibility is that a diploid individual has two of the same allele, in which case we call that homozygous.
Homo means same,
opposite of hetero. But notice that there's two ways that can happen. So heterozygous by itself is a self-contained word. We use that by itself. But we don't say only homozygous, because that doesn't give you enough information. A homozygous individual could have two dominant alleles, or could have two recessive alleles. So we use either dominant, homozygous dominant as a phrase to specify that individual, or homozygous recessive. We don't say heterozygous recessive or heterozygous dominant. Just heterozygous is enough. All right, everyone understand all those definitions. Let's then go on to 6 and revisit this same exact cross we just looked at, now with the new knowledge of what's happening at the molecular level, at the level of the gene. So we have the same P generation, but the new information here is that we have these strings of symbols. So this brings up another pair of definitions, one of which is phenotype, and the other of which is genotype. Now, phenotype refers to the actual observable trait of an individual. For whatever characteristic you're interested in, the particular trait is the phenotype. And it's not always something that you can see. It's just that humans are such visually oriented animals that we usually use visual examples, like flower color. But it could be how fast an enzyme works, for instance, or it could be anything. But this is a nice, easy to understand visual phenotype. Okay? But when I say observable trait, that doesn't mean necessarily that you're looking at it. It's just measurable. Anyway, so really, phenotype and trait are pretty interchangeable. Genotype, on the other hand, refers to the particular set of alleles that that individual or that cell has. All right? And for phenotype, we use descriptive phrases like purple flowered. That's a phenotype for an individual, or white flowered. Right, that's a wordy description of the trait. But we don't use words to describe the genotype. We use symbols, strings of symbols, like these letter P's, not the fruit that we're looking at, the P's as the letters. All right, now notice that the purple-flowered and the white-flowered individuals both have genotypes made up of only letter P's. And P stands for purple. The reason they chose a P is because purple happens to be the dominant trait. But we use P to denote white as well, just to remind us that P is dominant in the situation. And we therefore have to have another way to denote whether the alleles are dominant or recessive. So an uppercase P means specifically a purple allele, whereas a lowercase P means a white allele. Why do these genotypes for each individual include two P's? Right, because they're diploid individuals. Each parent is a diploid. So each parent has two flower color alleles. And the genotype tells you what they are explicitly. That's what a genotype is, a listing of all the alleles of the type you're interested in. So you can tell that they're diploid simply because there are two P's in each one, two letter P's. Okay? You can also tell that they are true breeding in which by what is another word that you just learned that's analogous to, or that's the same thing as true breeding? Any guesses? Which one? Yes, homozygous. Homozygous means true breeding. You can tell by looking just at this genotype that this is a homozygous individual because it has only one kind of allele. It has two of them, but it's only one kind, purple version. This one's homozygous dominant. This one's homozygous recessive. Okay? Now, those are the individuals. If you're going to cross them, you don't use the entire individuals. You use their gametes. And therefore, gametes have to first be produced. If it's a diploid individual producing gametes, what process leads to those gametes being produced? Meiosis. Exactly. And meiosis, basically, among the other things we discussed meiosis does, in the process of meiosis, a coin is flipped for a diploid to see which of these two, not separate alleles, but which of the two chromosomes that are carrying the alleles is chosen for a given cell, for a given gamete. Well, in a homozygous individual, it doesn't matter which one you choose. They're the same as each other. So that's why it doesn't matter which of these peas you choose. This purple-flowered individual, homozygous purple-flowered individual, can make only one kind of gamete when all you care about is flower color. We're ignoring all the other variability in all the other characteristics. The only kind of allele it can pass on is uppercase P, because that's all it has. Similarly for the white-flowered, except it can only pass on a lowercase p. But notice that the gametes, egg and sperm, have genotypes that are haploid. Just one p in a genotype means it's haploid, which exactly what should be the case for gametes, right? Because gametes combine to form diploid zygotes, so they have to be haploid to do that. Okay, well, when these get together, you produce the F1 generation. And we've already talked about the fact that he observed 100% of the individuals in the F1 generation being purple, like the purple-flowered parent. Well, this explains why. Since each parent can make only one kind of allele, when you get the two alleles together to form a diploid zygote, the only possible genotype for the diploid offspring is uppercase P, lowercase p, which is a heterozygous individual. In other words, molecularly speaking, every one of the F1s are heterozygous individuals, which we can call in one term heterozygotes. All right? But because of complete dominance of purple over white, that means every one of them is going to be purple. Another way of thinking about dominance, by the way, is that to have the dominant trait requires only one dominant allele. That's enough. Now, you can have two dominant alleles, but it doesn't make you any more dominant in your trait. That's why these heterozygous F1s are just as purple as the homozygous purple parent. That extra dominant does not do anything in the case of complete dominance. And this also means, by the way, that the only way with complete dominance that you can have the recessive trait is to be homozygous recessive. Because having just one of your two alleles be dominant means the recessive is going to be wiped out. Well, not wiped out, but it's not going to show. All right? So this explains now why he saw 100% of purple-flowered individuals in the F1. Now we go to the F2 by taking one of the F1s, a male, and taking a female F1 and crossing them. Well, each of them is heterozygous, uppercase, lowercase P. So now each of them can make two different kinds of gametes. You can pick the uppercase P or the lowercase p in meiosis. So it can make this one individual can make two different kinds of sperm, an uppercase or a lowercase p. The other one can make two kinds of eggs, uppercase P or lowercase p. So what we have here on the bottom is what's called a Punnett square, named after the Englishman who devised it first. And this is really just a shorthand diagram for that represents a real biological process. What process is the Punnett square representing? Well, if you have sperm listed on one side and eggs on the other side, and you're getting those together, what's that? I'm talking about a process, though. What process is being represented by the Punnett square? A part of reproduction. What is the fertilization. The defining process of sex. It's what makes it sex. Okay? So yes, this a Punnett square represents the process of fertilization. And it's really just an exhaustive listing of every kind of gamete each parent can produce. And you simply match up egg with sperm in each of the little squares within the Punnett, or box within the Punnett square. Well, what do these boxes within the Punnett square represent? If you're getting an egg and a sperm together. No, plants don't produce kids. Zygotes, exactly. That's what fusion of egg and sperm in the process of fertilization create, right? They fuse to make one zygote. So each box within the Punnett square is a possible zygote for these two parents, these particular two parents. Now, importantly, this Punnett square does not mean these two parents are going to have four offspring. There's four boxes in the Punnett square because there are exactly four possible ways to get their gametes together. There's four possible zygotes. Now, really, there's an almost infinite number of zygotes, as I've talked about before, but we're ignoring all the other characteristics. So just for when all we care about is flower color, there's these four possible zygotes. And it doesn't mean it's going to have four. It might have one. It might have a billion. But if it has a billion offspring, these two parents, then what this Punnett square predicts, because a Punnett square is really just a prediction, is that 750 million of that billion, or three quarters of the billion, will be purple flowered, and 250 million, or one quarter of the offspring, will be white flowered. Now, how do we know what the phenotypes are, which are purple and white? By looking at the genotypes. The Punnett square gives you the genotypes. You match up uppercase P egg with uppercase P sperm, you're going to get a diploid uppercase P zygote. Because of complete dominance, that is going to be a purple flowered individual. But so will these two on the diagonals, which only have one uppercase P, because complete dominance requires only one uppercase P, right? That will still make it just as purple as the one that's homozygous here. And like I said before, the only way that an individual can have the recessive trait is to be homozygous recessive. So it would have to be a recessive egg meeting up with a recessive sperm, which is only one fourth chance. Okay, so I talked a little bit about ratios earlier, but there's two kinds of ratios shown in slide 7. They both come from the same cross we just looked at, but they're ratios of different things. So on the left, we have a phenotypic ratio. a ratio of phenotypes, in other words. And that's the famous 3-to-1. If we're talking about a Mendelian characteristic, or correspondingly a Mendelian gene, with those two requirements I told you about, then if you go through a monohybrid cross to the F2 generation, you're going to have a 3-to-1 dominant to recessive phenotype ratio. But we can also talk about a genotype or genotypic ratio, a ratio of genotypes instead of phenotype. And this has three numbers because there are three possible genotypes, right? Homozygous dominant, heterozygous, and homozygous recessive. And the famous Mendelian genotypic ratio for the F2 is 1:2:1. Now, the reason it's 1:2:1, it's actually easier to go back one and look at the Punnett square again, is that there's only one way to get two uppercase P's, but there's two ways to get an uppercase and a lowercase. You can get the dominant from the father, the recessive from the mother, or the dominant from the mother, the recessive from the father. So these two diagonal individuals, there's two of them, there's only one of these. So it's 1:2:1 genotypic ratio in the F2. All right, now that, we just have been using that one experiment, flower color. But all of that will hold for any Mendelian monohybrid cross, including his six other experiments, in which case he looked at different things like the height of the plant and how the leaves appear and whatnot. As long as it's a Mendelian characteristic, you'll get those 3-to-1 and 1:2:1 ratios if you go through with it. In slide 8, we're looking at a different kind of cross here. And this is called a test cross. And this is a cross that can be done to determine the genotype of an individual whose phenotype is dominant. First of all, think about what we've already said about complete dominance. If you have an individual that has, observably, the recessive trait, in this case it would be white flowers, you don't have to do any testing, right? Because if you can see that that individual has the recessive trait, you know its genotype just by looking at it. It has to be homozygous recessive in order to have the recessive trait. But if you see an individual that's purple-flowered, which is dominant trait, that's ambiguous because, as we were just talking about, there's two ways that can happen. In other words, is that purple-flowered individual homozygous dominant or homozygous recessive? Is it true breeding purple or is it non-true breeding purple? And that, for various reasons, can be valuable information. Like if you're trying to sell these things, you want them to be true breeders, maybe, if no one wants white ones. But whatever the case, if you want to know what the genotype is of a dominant phenotype individual, then you cross that dominant individual, this purple-flowered one, with a recessive individual. Now, there's two possibilities here, right? The two possibilities are that the purple-flowered individual is homozygous dominant or heterozygous. Oh, did I say homozygous recessive before? Sorry about that. The purple-flowered one is not homozygous recessive, obviously, right? It's either homozygous dominant or heterozygous. Those are the two possible purple ones. So I think I misspoke earlier. But those are the two possibilities, heterozygous or homozygous purple. That's why we have two Punnett squares here, not just one. We don't know the genotype, but we know it's one genotype or the other. It has to be either upper-upper P or upper-lower P. Those are the only two possibilities for purple. So we just draw two different Punnett squares, crossing it with the white one. And each of these two Punnett squares is a different set of predictions. And notice that if the purple-flowered individual is actually homozygous, that's the upper eggs, then when you cross it with the white-flowered individual, there's no possibility of white offspring. Which makes sense, right? A homozygous true breeding individual is only going to, a homozygous dominant individual is only going to be able to pass on a dominant trait to an offspring. And it only takes one dominant trait, or dominant allele, I should say, to give that individual the dominant trait. That's why this Punnett square is purely purple. On the other hand, though, if the purple-flowered one is heterozygous, it can make two different kinds of eggs. And therefore, you should see half of the offspring being purple and half of them being white. Those are the predictions, and then all you have to do is really go through with the cross and look at the results. Now, this is another reason why you wouldn't want to do this just once. If you do the cross and produce one offspring, let's say it's purple. What does that tell you? Well, not much, because you could have just gotten lucky, right? On the other hand, if it is white, that would be enough. Because white is impossible here. It means it would have to be this one. Okay? But if you do a lot of them, that way, even if you get all purple, odds are pretty damn good that it would be this Punnett square that's true. And the bigger the sample size, the more sure you are. That's why it's called a test cross, though. You're testing the genotype of a dominant phenotyped individual. All right, now in 9, we have another cross, but this is a little bit different from the cross we just looked at. Look at the parents in the P generation. How many characteristics are there here? That we're keeping track of? 4? No, not 4. It is 2. What are they? No, those are alleles. I'm asking about characteristics. Yellow and green are traits, not characteristics. Seed color, because it's not flower color, it's the color of the seed, or the pea, but seed. Yes, seed color and seed shape are the two characteristics. Okay, that's why it's 2. Now, there are 4 overall traits, but there's 2 traits for one characteristic, and there are 2 traits for the other characteristic. So there's only 2 possible seed colors here in the population, and there are only 2 possible seed shapes in the population. All right, remember, 2 is important. It has to be exactly 2 traits for a characteristic if you're talking about a Mendelian cross. And this one is Mendelian. The difference here between what we looked at before, which was a monohybrid cross, is that we are simultaneously paying attention to 2 different characteristics, which does not mean those characteristics have anything to do with each other. They're just, we're looking at them at the same time. Okay, so we're, instead of ignoring texture or shape, we're including it along with color. But notice the parents themselves. One of them is yellow, one of them is green. If that's all we cared about was color, that would be a monohybrid cross. But notice also that one of them is smooth or round, and one of them is wrinkled. If we did that by itself and didn't pay attention to color, that would be a monohybrid cross. What we have here, though, is a dihybrid cross because we are simultaneously paying attention to 2 different characteristics. That's the di part of dihybrid. The hybrid part is, once again, that the parents differ in their traits for each characteristic. All right? Now, when you have two different characteristics, which corresponds to two genes, each characteristic corresponds to a gene, right? And therefore, when you get down to genotypes, if there are two characteristics you're tracking, two genes, and you're talking about diploid individuals, which the parents are, a dihybrid genotype is going to involve a string of four letters, two Y's and two R's. Right? It's diploid, therefore it has two seed color alleles, and it also has two seed shape alleles for the other gene. Well, we use the same scheme here. Use a letter that denotes the dominant trait. So the dominant color is yellow. That's why color is denoted by Y's, and uppercase Y means yellow, whereas lowercase Y means green. The shape, the dominant shape, is round, which is why R is used for the other gene. Uppercase R means round, lowercase R means wrinkled. So not only is this a dihybrid cross, but we can be more descriptive of these parents by saying that one parent is a doubly homozygous dominant individual. Homozygous dominant for seed color, homozygous dominant for seed shape as well. And the other one is doubly homozygous recessive. So all that makes sense. So we have a four-letter genotype for these diploids. But they are true breeding. They're doubly homozygous. So when meiosis picks one of the Y's, it once again does not matter. It will also pick one of the R's, which doesn't matter. That means there's really only one possible gamete this doubly true breeding yellow round parent can make. You have to pick an uppercase R, you have to pick an uppercase Y. So that's its gamete. The only possible gamete from the other one is lowercase y, lowercase r. That means these two gametes, which are the only two possibilities getting together, is going to produce only one kind of possible offspring, genotype, upper lower y, upper lower r. In other words, a double heterozygous individual. But because of complete dominance, a double heterozygote is going to be yellow, the dominant color, and round, the dominant shape. Every one of the F1s, not just this individual, but however many are produced in the F1 are going to be yellow and round. Just like all of them were purple in the other. We're just paying attention to two different characteristics at a time here. Okay, if you get these, if you cross F1 with F1 to produce the F2, then you have a couple possibilities. That's why there are two Punnett squares shown here. The one on the left is the prediction you would get for corresponding to the hypothesis of dependent assortment. Dependent assortment would be the case in which how one tetrad lines up during meiosis depends on how other tetrads line up. And therefore, you wouldn't expect all four possibilities of gametes. Notice you would have either upper-upper or lower-lower for each parent. Notice, though, that these gametes are two letters long because they're haploid. There's one Y and one R in each gamete, as there should be for a haploid gamete, haploid genotype. Okay. Now, the second Punnett square corresponds to the hypothesis of independent assortment, which means that how one tetrad lines up at metaphase of meiosis does not depend on how the other tetrads line up. And I've already told you in a previous chapter that that is the truth. So this is the one that should actually agree with the actual results. But the reason it's a bigger Punnett square is because each heterozygous individual from the F1 can produce four different possible gametes with respect to these two characteristics. Just look at it this way. If you have upper, lower Y, upper, lower R, and you randomly choose a Y and an R, you can have upper, 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 lower, lower, upper, or lower, lower. Right? That's why each of them is going to make four different gametes, because it's this individual crossed with another individual of the same genotype. That's why it's a 16-box Punnett square, because there's 4 times 4 possibilities. But you just match them up and write down the genotypes first, because that's what you get from the gametes, or the genotypes. And then, knowing which of the traits are dominant for each characteristic, you simply fill in the phenotypes. And here we have another famous Mendelian ratio, phenotypic ratio, 9 to 3 to 3 to 1. You'll see this in the F2 of a dihybrid cross if the genes involved are Mendelian, if it happens in a Mendelian fashion. 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 means 9 dominant color and dominant shape to 3 dominant color recessive shape to 3 recessive color dominant shape to 1 recessive color recessive shape. There's only one way you can be both green and wrinkled here. You have to get your gametes that are both doubly homozygous. Okay? Anyway, 9 to 3 to 3 to 1. That's just a special one for dihybrid crosses. Well, 10 is another Punnett square using coins, and the reason coins are used here is because it's really just a probabilistic occurrence here. When we list the possible gametes, when we're restricting our attention to a single characteristic, if there are two possible gametes, like there were in the monohybrid cross, they're equally probable. You just randomly choose one of those gametes, which is exactly like flipping a fair coin. It's exactly as probable to get a head as a tail. So the probability of each is 1/2. Similarly for the other gametes, 1/2 of each. And getting them together, in other words, flipping a head and a head, which would be like getting this egg and this sperm together, you compute that mathematically or probabilistically by multiplying the individual probabilities. 1/2 times 1/2 is 1/4. And notice that if you add up all of the boxes of the Punnett squares, their probabilities have to add up to 1, which is 100%. So you wouldn't have to actually write your letters. If you were a computer, you could just work with the numbers. All right, what I've just finished up to this point is Mendelian genetics. And once again, the things I've talked about will be true if there are exactly 2 alleles for the characteristic that's being focused on, and if one of those 2 alleles is completely dominant over the other. That's not always the case, though, obviously, right? For instance, eye color, which is a human characteristic. There's not exactly 2 eye color traits, right? There's all kinds of them. So it's possible for there to be exceptions to Mendelian genetics. It's not that things are working differently at the molecular level, it's just that the ratios are not what you would expect for Mendelian genetics. So the rest of the chapter deals with non-Mendelian genetics, in other words, exceptions to Mendelian genetics. And there's different ways that there can be exceptions, starting with this one in slide 11. The name for this exception to Mendelian genetics is incomplete dominance. And really, the name itself should tell you that it's an exception, right? Because I just told you that one of the requirements for Mendelian genetics is that you have to have complete dominance. Obviously, incomplete dominance is not complete dominance. Well, how many characteristics are we looking at here? One characteristic. What is it? Flower color again, except it's no longer peas. I don't actually know what kind of flowers these are. Anyway, it's flower color. That's the one characteristic. We don't care about anything else. Notice, though, that there's three traits possible It is not, though, because there are three alleles. This is one of the things that's different about non-Mendelian genetics in this case. There are still only two alleles, the red version and the white version. And notice that they use in genetics, unfortunately, they use many different standards. If there were true standards, there would only be one. But for genotypes, we're no longer using one letter. Here we have C with a superscript that's either R or W. So C for a color, and the superscript tells you which version it is. So C super R is a red allele. C super W is a white allele. Notice that each of these individuals is true breeding or homozygous. Okay, so nothing new about that. It's also true that red here is dominant over white, but not completely. That's the difference. If this were complete dominance, then you wouldn't have any possibility of pink flowers, and you'd have a 3-to-1. In the F2 generation, you'd have 3-to-1 white, pink, 3-to-1 red to white. That's not what's going on here, though. When you cross these two, in the F1 generations, none of them is red, none of them is white. They're all pink, which is kind of halfway between red and white, right? You can make sense of this based on your knowledge of what genes do. Genes don't directly give the organism its traits, right? What gives it its traits? Proteins. But genes are involved because genes indirectly tell cells how to make proteins, right? So the color gene, the red allele of the color gene, if it's transcribed, will produce a messenger RNA that, when it's translated, will produce a protein that causes red color. All right? The white one actually doesn't produce white color, it just produces no color, which appears white to us. Now, if you are a homozygous dominant individual, red, CR, it shouldn't be surprising that the flowers are going to be red, right? You have two genes, each of which is being transcribed and then translated into proteins that make it red. But if you're a heterozygous individual, you have a red version and a white version. The white ones don't really do anything. The white gene is not really doing anything with respect to color. The red one is. But notice that a heterozygous individual is only going to be able to make half as much protein as a red protein as a homozygous dominant individual is. Because it only has one gene, the other one has two genes. So in the same amount of time, it can produce double the amount of proteins giving it redness. Right? Well, it depends on the gene as to whether or not a half dose is enough to give you the full color. Like in the purple pea-flowered ones, just having one gene operating for purpleness was enough to make it purple. And adding the other one didn't really have any additional effect. Here, though, it does, for whatever reason. And a half dose of redness gets you only halfway to red. That's why they're pink. Okay? And then when you cross those, you have the Punnett square on the bottom. It's not 3-to-1. It's 1-to-2-to-1, Because one quarter of these zygotes will get a double dose of red alleles, one from an egg, one from a sperm. That's going to make it fully red. Two will get a red and a white from the parents, which is going to make it reddish white or pink. And one quarter of them will get two doses of white. So that is incomplete dominance. Everything's happening the same way as far as the cell is concerned, it's just the ratios are different. Slide 12 is actually two additional exceptions, both in one slide. This is an exception for two different reasons. This uses human blood group as an example. Before I talk about the exceptions, there's dozens of different human blood groups, but there's really only two that are famous, and that's the ABO blood group and the RH group. Those are the ones that everyone knows because those are the ones that can kill you if you're not careful. The other ones are important for various reasons, but they're not going to kill you in a transfusion. So what we call the one blood type in humans, like A negative, that's really shorthand for the results of two different groups. A negative means A in the ABO group and negative in the RH group. And RH has nothing to do with ABO. Okay, so never mind the negative positive. We're just focusing on A, B, and O. The first reason why this is an exception to Mendelian genetics is that it's called, the name of the exception is multiple alleles. And that name, just like incomplete dominance, that name should tell you it's an exception, right? Because multiple here doesn't mean two or more. Multiple means three or more. Well, if you have three or more, you violate the assumption of, or the requirement of having exactly two alleles. Notice the alleles are I super A, I super B, or just I. The I here, in case you're interested, stands for immunoglobulin, which is the kind of protein that make up antibodies. All right? But there's three possible alleles for this gene. A, B, and O, you could call them, corresponding to their types. Just to give you a little background about how this works, antibodies are proteins produced for immunity. Their job, and I talked about them a little bit when we were talking about proteins a long time ago, their job is, because of their shape, to recognize corresponding shapes of things that are foreign to the body and therefore are potentially dangerous. That's what your immunity is about, right? You want to surveil your body, leave things that you recognize as your own cells alone, but other things you want to destroy. The things in general that antibodies can detect or recognize the shape of are called antigens. And so in as far as ABO blood type is concerned, the antigens are carbohydrates that are on the surface of the red blood cell, denoted here in cartoon form as triangles or circles. Okay, so the red blood cells have these carbohydrates attached to them. Those carbohydrates are antigens. And they can be recognized by particular kinds of antibodies. The antibodies are proteins that are not part of the red blood cell. They're part of the plasma, which is the liquid part of the blood outside of the blood cells. Now, importantly, a person doesn't want to have antibodies in his blood that can recognize his own antigens. Otherwise, his blood would attack his own blood. So, if a person has the A allele, that person's blood cells will have A antigens. And that person's antibodies in the plasma of the blood will be anti-B antibodies, ones that recognize B, not A, because B is foreign blood. Okay? But we would call that person a type A person. A type B person has B antigens and anti-A antibodies. Well, notice there's a couple of different ways you can be type A, either homozygous, both of your alleles are A, or AO. O doesn't correspond to any kind of antigen. And the O really is probably originally a zero, meaning nothing, but we call it O. So BB or BO both make you type B. All right, so that's multiple alleles. If you have both O's, you're a type O. That's one reason it's an exception, because there's more than two possible alleles. There's another thing going on here, though, which has nothing to do with the first one. The other exception is called codominance. And codominance, co means share. Codominance is the situation in which two different alleles simultaneously express their corresponding trait. Okay, so neither of them is dominated by the other. They are both dominating at the same time. And we can see this in a type AB person. A type A person is only type A. That's the trait. Type B person, only type B. But if you have one of each allele, A doesn't dominate over B, B doesn't dominate over A, they both are fully expressed at the same time. And so a type AB person is just as much a type A person as a fully type A, and at the same time, just as much a type B person as a fully type B person. We have both kinds of antigens, and therefore an AB person's plasma or antibodies wouldn't be there at all, because either kind of antibody would attack this, right? One that recognizes A or B, so that an AB person's not going to have either kind of antibody in it. And a type O person doesn't have either kind of antigen, and therefore that person's plasma has both kinds of antibodies that will recognize either A's, B's, or AB. This is why it's such a big deal about transfusing. And that's why you have things like the universal donor and the universal recipient. Careful with those, though. That means universal donor of blood cells, not plasma. You don't give whole blood to someone unless it's an exact match. But if you spin it in a centrifuge, you can give just the plasma or just the cells themselves, as long as you match it up properly. All right, that's where we're going to stop. Remind me that I'm on 13.